Good evening, and welcome to Senator Jim Risch's live ICE Town Hall conference call. This is Brad Hoagland, and I will serve as the moderator this evening. We hope you'll find this call informative. Before we begin, here's a short rundown of how the next hour will proceed. This is a live conference call with Senator Risch, and you are in a listen-only mode. In other words, you can hear me, but I can't hear you, nor can you hear each other until a question is asked. Throughout the call, you are welcome to ask a question. If you want to ask a question, please press star 3 on your telephone keypad. You will be then transferred to one or two Senator Risch's staff members who will take your name, hometown, and question. After you talk to a staff member, please stay on the line so you can ask your question directly to the senator. At various times during tonight's call, Senator Risch will be asking all listeners for their input on an issue, and you will have the opportunity to vote by pushing a number on your telephone. The call will last 1 hour, and we hope you can stay for the full hour, whether you want to ask a question or not. The phone lines are now open for you to ask a question. Remember to press star 3, and you'll be transferred to a member of Senator Risch's staff. With that, let's begin. Senator Risch, thank you for hosting tonight's conference call. I understand you have some comments to open up tonight's session.
Well, Brad, thank you very much, and I want to thank all of you who are taking the time to participate tonight, either through listening or asking a question. We will do our best to get to as many questions as we possibly can, and again, I appreciate your participation. This is a way by which we can reach out and talk to a lot of different people and give you kind of an overall picture of what's happening in Washington, D.C., and then also get some input from you on the issues that that are current. I think most everyone knows that there are a lot of issues that have cropped up even in recent days and recent weeks here in Washington, D.C. The situation, though, in D.C. is really driven by the by two things. One is the financial condition of the country, and the other is really a philosophical divide between two different poles of the American people. And, of course, that's reflected in the people that they elect to represent them, so that you have really a tug-of-war going on, which has been going on for about 3.5 decades in America, as to what we want for our country. What do we want to be? Do we want to be a country that, as we were for 200 years, where the country focuses on freedom and on self-reliance, self-determination, and people taking care of themselves, taking care of each other through families and the churches and other institutions? Or do we want to be much more in the European model, where you have a situation where you would have a very strong federal government, a very large federal government, and one that was very active in virtually every aspect of our lives and every issue and problem that comes down the pike. And indeed, we've been moving more and more in that direction. Today, the federal government is twice the size that it was in 2000. And we keep moving in that direction, and that ties in with the second issue, and that is the financial issue. These are very round numbers, but they're every number that every American should know. These numbers, or generally these numbers, most don't. Most are like I was before I got here. Even though I've spent almost all my adult life in public service, I was kind of the frame of mind that, well, you know, this is America. Nothing can possibly ever go wrong here. And having been here now for going on 4 years, I've certainly changed my mind in that regard. The country's financial condition is very precarious, substantially more so than what most Americans know. I think if you asked any American, any Idahoan, what do you think the financial condition of the United States is, most would say, oh, you know, it's not very good. But most couldn't recite the facts that that demonstrate just how bad it is. And I'll do that, and bear with me. I hate using numbers, but you really have to do this. The federal government this year will spend about $3.8 trillion. That comes down to about $11 billion a day, or about $7 million a minute. That's how much the federal government will spend. Unfortunately, the federal government doesn't have $3.8 trillion to spend. It will only take in about $2.2 trillion. So that means it will borrow $1.6 trillion, or a little over 40 cents out of every dollar that it spends will be borrowed. On a daily basis, that comes out to around $4.5 billion a day on the $11 billion that the federal government spends every day. And they pay their bills every night. They're not like most businesses or households that pay bills monthly. They pay daily because of the size of it, and simply because of the way things move. So they write checks for about $11 billion every evening. And during the day, they have gone out and borrowed about $4.5 billion so that they can balance the checkbook that night. Now, this is real borrowing. It's not make-believe. Before I came here, this was all kind of esoteric and not really didn't have a lot of specific meaning for me. I always kind of thought, I think, like most Americans, that, look, federal government's got the printing presses. They can print whatever they want. Well, they're not printing money. They're actually borrowing it. And I went and watched them do it. That's done by the Bureau of Public Debt. These are real people borrowing real money. They used to do it monthly, then weekly, then daily. Now they're down to multiple times a day because they can't pay their bills at night. And so they borrow the $4.5 billion every day. Now, that's the good news. The bad news is, in addition to the $4.5 billion of new money they need, figuratively, outside there's a line of people holding notes for $50 to $70 billion coming due that day of money that they've borrowed previously. And that's part of the national debt. So that has to be refinanced daily. So they borrow $50 to $70 billion of money to pay the debts of people who are holding our notes. So it is a frightening set of circumstances that we find ourselves in today. And so they borrow every day to pay the debts that are coming due, to pay the interest on the debts that are coming due, and to pay the bills, the new bills that are coming due. And it's all a very substantial amount of money, and it's all very real. And that's I think that underscores for people just how serious the situation is. To underscore it with a couple of other representations of what it's like. Remember, I said they spend about $11 billion a day and borrow $4.5 billion of that. When I was governor of the state, the state budget was about $3.5 billion. Now, that was for a year. Recall that I said they're borrowing $4.5 billion a day, every day, in order to pay the bills. In addition to that, if you back up to the amount I was talking about, that they spend $3.8 trillion, and the fact that they only take in $2.2 trillion, if you took the $2.2 trillion that came in and paid only Social Security, Medicare, not Medicaid, Medicare, and the interest on the national debt, just those three items, that would be the $2.2 trillion. There'd be no money left over for anything else, including national defense or the parks or Medicaid or anything else, really. And so, again, that underscores how serious the financial situation is in the country. And the Congress has not been successful in dealing with it. Indeed, I think we're going to have to get to a very difficult situation before it's dealt with. There's about a dozen of us here out of the 100 senators. There's 12, maybe 15 on a good day that think that this is a crisis situation. The other 85 believe that this is a problem. Some think it's a really serious problem. Others think it's not too serious a problem. And some of them are just what I said, and that is that, look, this is America. Nothing can possibly go wrong here. Well, I've been here. The national debt has increased from $10 trillion to right now knocking on the door of $16 trillion. This has got to stop, and there isn't anybody in this town any economist, any politician, anyone who thinks that that this is a sustainable model and that it can go on. There's models out there for what happens if this doesn't change, and of course, Greece comes to mind. So with that, that's kind of the state of play here in Washington. Thanks for letting me give you an oversight of the thinking here and the problems and what's going on. And with that, why don't we open it up for a question, Brad? Who's our first question?
Yeah, we'll get that. Let me remind people, since we've had a lot of people join us since you started with your opening remarks. For those of you who have joined us, welcome. You're part of Senator Risch's iTown Hall meeting. And if you want to ask the senator a question, press *3 to be placed in the question queue. You can do that at any time during the conference call, and we'll try to get to as many questions as possible tonight. And for some reason, Senator, there are a ton of people calling about something that happened last Friday. Had to do with an executive order and something the president did. And so we'll just grab someone here. I've got a William from Boise who has a question about this. He and a bunch of other people want to know about this. William, are you on?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead, William.
Thank you, Senator Risch, for all that you do. You know, you're a beacon of light, and I think all of us in Idaho truly appreciate what you do. The question is, Mr. Obama signed an executive order dealing with the illegals on Friday. Shouldn't this be under the authority of Congress, and isn't this probably more of a political ploy than it is as far as something of real value for him?
Well, you know, your question really states its own answer. I couldn't say it much better than myself, but, you know, the policy and the law of America is set by the United States Congress. The Founding Fathers made it so. They gave us a legislative branch, an executive branch, and a judicial branch. The legislative branch, which represents the people, which are the elected representatives from all the different states, set the law. And we have a very clear law on what immigration is. We have a law which allows certain amounts, certain kinds of legal immigration. The law also is very specific on people who have entered the country illegally and who are here in the country illegally. There's really three aspects to the immigration issue facing America today, and we're going to focus on just the one aspect of it. The other two, the first one being the closing of the borders, we really have not done a good job of that, and that's really got to be done before anything else. We're one of the few countries in the world that have an open border like we have that really lets people come in, not intended that they should come in this way, but they do enter illegally. We're one of the few countries that have a border like that, and as long as you have that, we Americans are going to continue to have the problems that we have. Everybody wants to come to America, and I've got we don't have time for it here, but I've got I'm on Foreign Relations Committee and on the Intelligence Committee. I travel some, and I've got all kinds of stories about how badly people want to come to America. So having said that, they do come here, and they do come here, some legally, some illegally, and the law is very clear on how those are to be handled. The second aspect of it is we do need a legal immigration policy that is workable, that's smooth, and that that meets the things that America wants regarding immigration. We're a country of immigration. We welcome legal immigration that has limits on it and sideboards on it. We need to do that. On top of that, there are a number of things when it comes to immigration that are needed for certain elements of the workforce to enter this country. Certainly we need immigration help on the in the agricultural industry, and most people don't understand that we also need it in the high-tech industry. We can't come anywhere near filling all those jobs. So we need policies and laws that promote that are good for the American interests here, And that's also an issue. Now let's turn to the third one, and that is the fact that there's about 11 million people here that are here illegally. And what President Obama did last Friday was deal with just the third one, which he himself recognizes is wrong. I want to quote what he said a year ago. Now, this is an exact quote from President Obama from a year ago. Quote, "This notion that somehow I can just change the laws unilaterally is just not true. There are laws on the books that I have to enforce. I think that there's been a great disservice done to the cause of getting the DREAM Act passed by perpetrating the notion that by myself I can go and do these things," end quote. The president was absolutely right when he said that. It shows he understands what the situation is regarding these laws, and yet on last Friday, he did exactly the opposite of what his understanding of how this is to be handled legally. So, having said all that, one can't help but wonder if this was done purely for political purposes. He'd had a very, very bad week during the week. He had stood up and made a comment, not off the cuff. He did it during a prepared speech that the private sector was doing just fine, and even his own party, the people were winching at that, knowing that that simply isn't the case out there. I think it spoke volumes. But in any event, he cleared all that bad stuff off the table by doing this, and it's just wrong. And how it's going to shake out, I don't know. His job is to enforce the law, and the law is very clear that if you've entered this country illegally, you can't stay here. He has said he's not going to do that, and frankly, it's stunning that a president, a public official, any public official, would stand up and say, "I'm not going to obey the law." The law applies to each and every one of us, whether we're the president of the United States or whether we're any citizen or anyone else. We have to obey the law. He didn't, and I suspect that there's going to be litigation over it and quite a bit of other fallout from it. So that's a really good question. Having said that, all these issues need to be dealt with. They need to be resolved, but they need to be resolved by the elected officials from all the different states that make up the United States Congress after hearings and after debate and after give and take and compromise on bills that come before Congress. And it certainly shouldn't be done by one person in what is clearly an illegal fashion. Thank you so much for that question, and we will we'll move on from here.
In fact, Senator, I think at this time you had a poll question you wanted to get feedback from the people on about this very issue. Did you want to do that poll question at this time?
You know, that's probably a good thing. We've got some poll questions that we're going to let everybody get their 2 cents worth on, and here's how I'm going to do this. I'm going to ask this question. Now, don't vote until I tell you how to do it, and you won't be able to vote. Your vote won't be recorded until I tell you to go ahead and vote. But this is the question you're going to vote on. The question is, on Friday, President Obama issued a directive that allows illegal immigrants who came to this country as children, the ability to stay in the United States. And the question is going to be, do you agree with his decision? And when you vote, you're going to press 4 if you agree with the president and press 6 if you disagree with the president's action. So let's go ahead and open the phone for voting now. If you agree with the president, press 4. And if you disagree with the directive that he issued, press 6. And we'll move on from there. So, Brad, let's move to the next question.
Yeah, Senator, just a reminder, we still have more people who've joined us. If you want to ask a question, press *3 to be placed into the question queue. I know staff is working as hard as they can to get to everybody, and it does take a little bit of time. And remember, if you've asked your question or talked to staff and you're waiting, hang on, don't hang up. We're going to try to get to as many questions as possible tonight, and hopefully we can get to you. We do have a question, Senator. A gentleman from North Idaho, Drexel from Athol, has a question for you regarding the EPA. Drexel, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead, sir.
Well, it seems apparent to me that we're not going to be able to count on the federal government to do anything to take care of Idaho or its citizens. And I think we are fortunate to have a state with a lot of natural resources that can be utilized by the private sector to generate income and products and make Idaho healthy. And I think we're being stifled by the EPA and other individuals that seem to think that our natural resources are just to be looked at. And we can see what happened in Colorado and places like that, where millions of board feet have just been burned up and wasted.
Well, there's a lot of questions there. Jexel, first of all, let me tell you, I share your feeling about the loss of timber through fire. My undergraduate degree was in forestry, and any time I see that kind of waste, you just can't help but have a sick feeling. We've gotten to the point. If you look at the harvest of board feet from every forest in America, every single one of them, if you do a bar graph, you look at it, it just year after year it goes down and down and down. When my first year in the Idaho legislature was in 1975. At that time, there were 43 operating mills south of the Salmon River. Today, there's two. One at Evergreen, and there's one in Emmett, and it was open. I'm not even sure that one's open anymore. But it's just a sad state of affairs. When you talk about the EPA and the regulatory matters, let me give you a number that's going to be eye-opening, I think, for most people. Last year, Congress passed about 2,000 pages of legislation. Now, that included all the spending bills, which take up a good chunk of that 2,000 pages. But the bureaucracy, the various departments of the federal government passed 70,000 pages, 70,000 pages of rules and regulations, all of which have the same force and effect as law. So you can see who's actually doing the legislating as opposed to the legislative branch. We have virtually no ability to do anything about those of us that have been elected by Idahoans. I meet almost every day with CEOs and management people from the job creators in America, the companies, the small and small businesses, medium-sized businesses, and almost to the person, they tell me that the regulatory structure that is happening in America is a huge wet blanket on the economy and indeed on their decision to expand, to do more, to hire people. They will tell me, Senator, I'm just not interested in investing more. I'm not interested in building, or I'm not interested in hiring more people, as long as we have a regulatory structure that we have, where every day and every time we turn around, we're facing more barriers to doing business, to creating jobs, to making this economy work. And they say, until this thing turns around, we just simply aren't going to do it here. We simply aren't going to do it. Probably the best one of the poster children for that kind of an example is Caterpillar that wanted to build a new plant. They operate in Illinois, and they bought Bucyrus Erie, so they operate in Wisconsin also. They had the choice of building in Illinois that had just increased their corporate income tax 67%, or in Wisconsin where there's great political turmoil while the state attempts to get a handle on its indebtedness that's sinking the state. And so they made the decision to build a new plant in Singapore. And that's happening more and more. We see more and more jobs going overseas. And I'm told over and over and over again by the people who are the decision makers in these companies that create jobs that they just can't, they simply are afraid to expand here or to develop here with the regulatory structure that we have. So we fight this every day. We hear complaints every day about the regulatory burdens that are facing American business. So thanks for that question. We're keeping up the fight on that. We're going to continue to do it and hope to turn it around with some more help. Brad, we
also have a lot of people calling asking about the debt ceiling. And so we're going to go to Ann in Sandpoint and let her ask that question, representing a lot of people from around the state who have that question. Ann, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yes, Ann, go ahead.
Yes, Senator, I'd like to speak to the current status of the debt ceiling. I just recently heard in one of the news broadcasts that it seems like a possibility that we may exceed it before the November election. And so I'd like to know what you've been hearing in Washington and just what's going on.
Well, Ann, that's a really great question. Thanks so much. We are bumping up or going to bump up against the debt ceiling again in the future. The debt ceiling is in a bar that was put in place by the United States Congress that says that the executive branch cannot borrow any more than X. And we keep coming up against it because of you heard my explanation earlier about how badly we're going in debt, how quickly we're going in debt. And the last time this was done, they wanted to put it beyond the election. I'm not so sure they got it done. I've heard it argued both ways, that we will hit it before the election, and I've heard it argued that they'll be able to put it off until after. Frankly, I'd like to see it done before the election. I think that's a really, really good time to have a dialogue on what's going to happen with the spending in this country. There's the description I gave of you of how bad it is as far as the spending is concerned. Does not, you'll notice missing from that description is the fact that how do we get out of this? What are people talking about back there? Well, there is a lot of arguing going on back here, but there is no plan in place. There really hasn't been any settlement of how this is going to be addressed. And the only discussion when we hit the debt ceiling is, well, what are we going to do about raising the debt ceiling? Now, there's various things that can be done when you get there, but having that dialogue before the election, I think, is really important. Fully one-third of the U.S. Senate is up for election. All of the United States House of Representatives is up for election, and the President of the United States is up for election. And every voter should listen carefully to what those people say about how they intend to vote, what their view of this is, and they should do that before they cast the ballot. I think that'll make for a much more informed electorate as we go into Election Day. Whether we'll actually get to that day before Election Day, I guess we won't know probably for another 60 days or so. But, and that's a great question. Thank you so much for that. We're, as I told you, we are, when I got here 3.5 years ago, the national debt was $10 trillion, and now it's knocking on the door $16 trillion. And unfortunately, when I say that, I can't really comprehend the consequences of that. I doubt anyone can because of those numbers. They're so big, they're so overpowering that it really loses its meaning. The dangerousness of it, the magnitude of the problem is so big that our minds just the human mind really has a tough time conceiving what that is. Great question, and thanks so much, Brad. Where are we headed here?
Well, Senator, lots of people still coming on, that may not have heard me the last time, but press *3 if you want to ask a question. And another question that's out there that a lot of people have is about the economic crisis and possibly what Congress is going to do it. And we'll let John from Nampa ask that question since that's his question. A lot of people have that same question. So, John, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead, John.
Hi, Senator. How are you today?
Good. Thank you so much for calling.
You're welcome. Hey, I noticed you were talking about the debt crisis and the fact that we're borrowing $4 billion a day to pay it. And you said that Congress wasn't addressing this issue yet because it wasn't drastic enough or wasn't a big enough crisis. How much more of a crisis do we need to be in before they start addressing it?
I ask myself that same question every day. It is stunning that they borrow $4.5 billion a day, and like I said, almost everyone says, "Oh, well, we shouldn't do this," or "this isn't a good idea," or what have you. I ask economists, and we hear from lots and lots of economists. I ask them, I say, "How is this going to play out? What are the mechanics here of how this starts to unravel?" Because you heard me describe how the Bureau of Public Debt every day goes out and borrows this money. We've never had a failed auction. Other countries have. America never has had a failed auction. They tell me if we ever do that everything's going to come to a screeching halt, which I believe. But our very existence, and this is the thing that angered me so much when I left watching them borrow and caused the fear that I have, and that is the existence of the greatest country in the world depends upon the Bureau of Public Debt every day being able to borrow this money. Now, where's this money coming from? Well, the day I was there, they about a third of it came from China, about a third of it came from other, excuse me, about a fourth of it came from China, about a fourth of it came from other countries, and about half of it came from wealthy banks, institutions, trusts around the world. So I asked the economists, what happens? How does this unwind? I mean, we can't continue to go in debt like this every day. And there you get various answers, but the consensus after listening to all these people is that at some point in time what happens is just what's happening to Spain right now, and that is our borrowing costs start to really spiral on us. And when they do, of course, that makes it becomes a death spiral. You have to borrow more money in order to continue on. And so when that starts to happen, I think that it becomes I think more people will agree with me that this is a financial crisis that we're in right now. But that's a really good question. I lay in bed and worry about that at night. I lay in bed and think about it at night. And I'm glad to hear somebody else ask that question, because I'm always troubled by the fact that when I go around and give speeches and talk to this, people shake their head, and most people, although they know that the financial condition of the country is bad, they don't really have a comprehension of how bad it is. So I think that's how it's going to unwind. I think what you do is you see the interest rates start to skyrocket, and of course that will creep into the private sector also. That will hit all the rest of us at the same time as the cost of money goes up. There's only so much money around, and when the federal government is competing to get their hands on it, they're going to be competing with the private sector and with other countries to try to get it. So thanks so much for that question. That was great. Brad?
Senator, we're going to go to Sean in Tetonia. He's kind of got a follow-up question to that. Might fit. Sean, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, can you get a little closer to the phone? You sound far away.
Yeah, that my question was answered in the last go-around there. I got it.
Okay, great. Just wanted to be sure.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
And, Senator, I guess now's a good time to go to the poll about Idaho's economy, since we're talking about spending and borrowing. Of course, you being in the state legislature for a long time, Idaho doesn't borrow, but you were talking earlier tonight about how Idahoans looking at their economy, and you wanted to find out how they felt about it. So what do you have for that one?
Well, Brad, thank you. What we do for those of you who've called in, when we do these telephone town hall meetings, what we try to do is get a handle on how you feel about what's happening in Idaho. And as Brad pointed out, Idaho can't borrow money. That's a good thing. It's really unfortunate it's not in the U.S. Constitution. I've been a co-sponsor, as many others have, of the balanced budget amendment to the U.S. Constitution. If we had that in the U.S. Constitution, that could turn this thing around. Indeed, it would have to turn around. Couldn't happen overnight. We'd have to ease into it. But if we could do what Idaho and almost every other state does, and that is have a balanced budget requirement so that the federal government had to run like the states and like businesses and like our homes, we could get this thing straightened out. But the question, I'd kind of like to get a feel as to what Idahoans think about how the economy is doing in Idaho. So I'm going to ask a question here. Don't start voting until I tell you to. But I'm going to ask a question that about how the Idaho economy is doing compared to 6 months ago. And to put this in proper perspective, 6 months ago would be December 17th. So think about Christmas time or shortly before Christmas time, how you felt the economy was then and how you feel the economy is doing now. Obviously, there's some objective measurements out there, but the thought process that each of you have is really important to me. So I'd like to ask you this question. How is Idaho's economy doing today compared to what it was 6 months ago? And don't vote yet, but I'm going to have you press 4 for better, 5 for worse, and 6 about the same, neither better nor worse. So the question again, how is Idaho's economy doing today compared to what it was doing 6 months ago or about the middle of December of last year? So go ahead and vote now. If you think it's better today than it was 6 months ago, press 4. If you think it's worse than it was 6 months ago, press 5. And if you think it's about the same, neither better nor worse, press 6. Thank you so much. Brad, where are we going next?
I'm here, Senator. Sorry about that. I couldn't get unmuted for some reason, but I'm back. I was saying that we do leave that open for about a minute or so to let people vote. But we're going to go to Brad, no relation here. I just happen to have the same first name in Twin Falls. So I like the name. Brad, Twin Falls, go ahead, ask Senator Risch your question.
Yeah.
Brad, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to know what Senator Risch, what the three things that he's going to be focusing his time and efforts on in this next session that comes in.
Let me follow that up. When you say the next session, are you talking about from now until the end of the year, or are you talking about after the first of the year? What time period are you referring
from
to?
From now until the end of the year.
Okay. I suspect my answer would be the same either way. But I have to tell you that as you've heard me speak this evening, There really only is one issue that is so dominant that it really makes all other issues dwarf compared to it, and that is the financial condition of the country. We have just got to get a handle on spending, and that's what I'm focused on really more than anything else. It's what keeps me awake at night. Certainly. Since I'm on foreign relations and intelligence, I deal with those kinds of issues every day. I deal with obviously with immigration, with health care, with tax rates, with Medicare, Medicaid, a new farm bill, an energy bill, the debt ceiling, as we talked about earlier, the appropriation bills. I'm going to deal with every one of those. Obviously, we have relations with over 200 countries in the world, and every one of those is different and incredibly interesting. But I come back to, what are we going to do about getting our hands on this spending? And in order to give you, again, a little bit better flavor of that, the most of the spending, and the spending that's causing the problem, is what is referred to as entitlement programs. I don't like that. Label, because some of them I don't view are entitlements, but in any event, one misconception I think most Americans have is that Social Security is contributing to this, and Social Security really isn't contributing much to the problem at all right now because it is modestly solvent or close to it in the short term. The problem is the long term, and it is really the Social Security issue is really solvable, relatively easy, without changing the benefits or reducing benefits for anyone who's on Social Security or who's going to come on Social Security for the next 8 or 10 years. It can be solved, but there's got to be some changes that are made. If not, it is going to be a real problem. The thing that's causing most of the issue in America today is the cost of health care. It's the cost of Medicare and the cost of Medicaid that are driving the national deficit and the national debt. Both of those, because of the skyrocketing cost of health care, are contributing to that. And we deal with things every day with exploring how we can reduce the cost of health care. Since Obamacare came into play, the cost of insurance of health care has gone up 23%, and that's been that hasn't been that long ago. So that kind of tells you how it's skyrocketing since the federal government is involved so heavily both in Medicare and Medicaid. Both of those are really driving the deficit and debt situation today. My view on Social Security and Medicare are these are benefits that were earned by people, and they've got to be protected and should be protected. And it's not only a legal obligation but a moral obligation. And we need to make changes, but those changes wouldn't affect anybody who is receiving benefits today or who is soon to receive benefits. And really, these things can be straightened out if you reach down the road a little bit and make some changes that will affect future beneficiaries. And that does two really important things. Number one, it would guarantee the existence of the program and the continuation of paying the benefits. And secondly, what it would do is those that are planning for the future would have some certainty that, number one, they were going to get some benefits, and number two, what the level of those benefits would be so that they could plan around it. In any event, that's what I'm going to focus on. That's what I've been focused on. It's kind of a big-picture approach, but those are the things that I'm looking at. Thanks for the question.
Thank you, Brad. Senator. And in fact, we've got quite a few callers. Apparently, the Supreme Court's going to be deciding something very shortly, and we've had a lot of people wanting to know about this issue, and we're gonna have Jane from Lava Hot Springs represent those callers with her question. Jane, go ahead.
Hi. Hey.
Hi, Jane.
You know, if the Supreme Court decides that this Obamacare, so-called, is unconstitutional, that's fantastic. That's reality. Now, if it goes the opposite way, and then, you know, we're told that, guess what, you guys, we don't think it's unconstitutional. What's next? What's going to happen? Is this the new world order? Is this what's going to happen to all of us? We lose our constitutional rights completely?
Well, you know that's a really good question. We talk about it back here every day. We do anticipate that the Supreme Court will issue its ruling on the health care bill either Thursday of this week or a week from today, next Monday. And they'll do one of three things. They're either going to validate it completely, or they're going to invalidate it completely, or the more likely scenario that people think is going to happen is that they will invalidate part of it and validate other parts of it. And in any event, virtually everyone who's dealing with this agrees that we got to do something different. Obamacare isn't working. The cost of it is substantially higher than what it was represented to be at the beginning. And as a result of that, we're going to have to do something differently. And obviously, we've been talking about it for a long time, and there are things that that the federal government can do on an overall basis to reduce the cost of health care in America. And I think that that's what's going to be focused on. And whatever the Supreme Court does, that is not the end of the issue. I mean, even if the Supreme Court affirms it in its entirety, I think there's going to be a continued push to repeal it and to replace it with other things that would be that would serve the American people better, and specifically in the area of cost cutting. You know, as everybody knows, that health care bill was passed on an absolute total 100% party line vote, with Republicans voting no, Democrats voting yes to a person in the United States Congress. That's the first time anything that big has ever passed on a straight party line vote. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, all of those were negotiated. None of them were a straight party line vote. And it's better if both people have their hands on it. And I suspect that at the end of the day, when this is resolved, there will be some give and take. The thought process, each party approached it on a different basis. When I first ran in 2008, that was the hot topic, and everybody running was talking about health care reform. We were singing off two different sheets of music. The Republicans, when they talked about health care reform, they meant reducing the cost of health care. The Democrats, when they were speaking of it, they were focused not on reducing the cost, but rather on the people that were covered, how many people were covered. At that time, 87% of Americans had some kind of health care coverage. And the president wanted to do is he wanted universal care where 100% would be covered. The federal government would take care of it. They'd just collect taxes. They would deliver all the medical care, and that would be the end of it. They weren't even able to get that done within their own party. And they wound up with Obamacare, which moved the needle 7%. That is, instead of 87% being covered, there are now 94% of people being covered. Unfortunately, the cost of it was absolutely staggering, and it was one of the many straws that are being put on the camel's back, and the question is which one's going to do it. So at the end of the day, it's going to be changed. How it's going to be changed, I can't predict yet, but what I will promise is that when it is changed, there will be much more of a focus on the cost of health care. So thanks very much for that question. And
Senator, that rolls into one of the poll questions you wanted asked tonight, and that was about health care. And if the Supreme Court does declare a portion of it unconstitutional, what should Congress do? And do you want to let the folks know what they should be voting on that?
Well, Brad, that's good, and let's do that. Don't start voting yet, but. The question I'm going to ask is if the Supreme Court declares portions of the act unconstitutional, what should Congress do next? And I guess the question should be better put, if the Supreme Court declares all or portions of the act unconstitutional, what should Congress do next? Don't vote yet, but these are going to be your choices. I'm going to have you press number 4 if you believe Congress should do nothing and let the states work this out. I'm going to ask you to press number 5 if you want Congress to reinstate as much of the act as possible. I'm going to ask you to press number 6 if you want Congress to work on reducing the cost of health care only. So the question is, if the Supreme Court declares portions of the Health Care Act unconstitutional this Thursday or next Monday or whenever it acts, what should Congress do next? Press 4 if you believe Congress should not deal with this and let the states work this out. Press 5 if you want Congress to reinstate as much of the act as possible, and 6 if you want Congress to work on reducing the cost of health care only. So you can go ahead and vote now. 4 if you want the states to handle it, 5 if you want Congress to reenact as much of it as possible, and 6 if you want Congress to focus on reducing the cost of health care only. Okay, Brad, let's go to another question.
You bet, Senator. And again, we leave that open for folks for a minute or two to get those responses in. And we do post this on the website a couple days after this, so folks can see what the results are and the responses to your questions. And right now we have a question from Rose up in Coeur d'Alene. Rose, go ahead with your question to Senator Risch.
Thank you for taking my call, Senator. It is my understanding that the Senate is supposed to propose and pass a budget each year. However, no budget has been passed for approximately 3 years. How can Harry Reid not submit a budget, and do we need a law demanding this be done each year?
Rose, that's a great question. First of all, let me say I was in Coeur d'Alene this weekend. I was there Friday for meetings, and gosh, the weather was just perfect there on Friday, and the hospitality was great as always. Glad to be in Coeur d'Alene. Good question on the budget. Rose, we already have a law, and it requires the Congress by April 15th adopt a budget. And the Democrats have not put forth a budget that they would adopt here in the United States Senate. Now, let me say that since the Republicans took over the House of Representatives, they have passed a budget. They've passed a budget every single year, and they've sent it over to the Senate. And we do our best to force a vote on it. And there are some ways in which you can force a vote on the budget here in the Senate. And so we have forced a vote on the budget, but every time we do, it's a straight party line vote with the Republicans voting for the Republican budgets that we put on the table. The Democrats never put a budget on the table. However, the president does put a budget on the table as he's required to do by law. And the Democrats won't let us vote on it voluntarily, but we do force a vote every year. And this is the second year in a row where we have voted on the president's budget, and it got zero votes. It got no votes from the Republicans. It got no votes from the Democrats. And the Democrats don't put their own budget on the table. So we have the Republican budgets, which they vote down, and you have the president's budget, which they vote down. And it is a violation of law. There's no question about it. The law requires that Congress adopt a budget by April 15th of each year. And by the way, it's that law that allows us, the Republicans, to force a vote on the president's budget and to force a vote on the budgets that the House has sent us. So that's how we do that. But it's a stunning proposition that the largest entity, financial entity in the world, the United States of America, is operating without a budget. I mean, the federal government spends $3.8 trillion without a budget. There isn't another business, there isn't a family that doesn't operate on a budget. And it's just emblematic of how bad the situation is here, that Congress is unable to adopt a budget for handling this. So you ask, well, how do you operate? Well, what happens is a continuing resolution is generally passed that allows things to just kind of go on the way they are. And it's an awful, awful, awful way to do business, but that's what's being done. Rose, that's a great question. I wish I could tell you how to resolve it, but all we can do is vote on the stuff that Harry Reid puts in front of us, or force a vote when we have a vote when we have a law like the one that requires a budget. Okay, Brad.
Yeah, Senator. Before we get to Patton Hollister, and he gets the honor of being the last questioner tonight, for those people that are still in the queue, yet to be screened, we want you to know that we want you to stay on the call tonight. You'll be able to leave a brief message for the senator, and you will receive a response. And as always, you can leave a message with Senator Risch at his office here in Washington, D.C., or one of his six state offices. And you can find those numbers on the website for risch.senate.gov. That's risch.senate.gov. And you can also sign up for future town halls and for Senator Risch's electronic newsletter. And, of course, as I mentioned earlier, the audio from this conference call will be posted. So with that advertising out of the way, we'll go to Pat in Hollister. Pat, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead, Pat.
I would like to know what is trying to be done about the national security leaks that's taking place possibly by the White House?
Gosh, that is an absolutely superb question. I wish that had been the first one. We could have spent an hour on that. But you know, this is really a despicable state of affairs. The United States of America operates an intelligence service which is second to none in the world. They are very, very good at collecting intelligence. They're very good at acting on that intelligence. But whenever politics gets mixed up in this, it gets pretty bad, and that's exactly what's happened recently. You'll note the closer we get to the election, the more security leaks that there are. First of all, let us say this, and everyone should agree with this, and that is that our intelligence agencies have done a very good job since September 11th. We've had a couple of close calls, but we have not had another loss of any magnitude on our homeland soil. And that, you have to give credit to the intelligence agencies. There's a number of intelligence agencies. As I told you, I sit on the intelligence committee. Our job is twofold. It's number one, to oversee them, to see that they don't trample on United States citizens' rights, but at the same time to see that they do their job and to properly collect and act on intelligence. The one I'm going to focus on just one, and that is there's a gentleman, and I use that word loosely, operating in Yemen, who's a bomb maker for Al Qaeda. He has been very, very active and has come very close to getting an American airliner a couple of times. The most notorious one, of course, is one that most Americans are familiar with, and that was on Christmas Day over Detroit, where they had a bomb constructed in the underwear of a terrorist, and it malfunctioned, and as a result of that, the plane didn't go off, and the plane didn't come down. Most recently, I'm neither going to confirm nor deny these facts. What I'm going to tell you is what was reported in the New York Times, and that is that they had an agent who was dealing with this person and was able to get his hands on the latest and greatest model that he had produced, which could come through security. And we actually got our hands on it. We were able to look at it, dissect it, and better guard ourselves for people who were getting on an aircraft carrying this type of a device. That leaked, and when it did, it fully compromised the operation. That person's life was in jeopardy, but more importantly, the lives of everybody getting on and every airliner is in jeopardy, because we had a direct pipeline to this fella in Yemen. We don't have that anymore, according to the reports that have been published. And it's really unfortunate. We're going to continue to work on these. We want to see people prosecuted because this is a matter of this is a matter of national security. It's a matter of keeping every American safe, every American that gets on an airliner and otherwise in the homeland, in our homeland. So, thanks so much for that question. It's one we could talk about for a long, long time, but it is a really serious problem. Brad?
Well, Senator, that's all the time we have for. Give you about 30 seconds to wrap up, say goodbye, thank you, whatever you want to say. Senator, you're the boss.
Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate that. Thank all of you. I want to thank all of you that took the time to participate in this. We really covered a broad range of issues in this. We do these regularly, and I have to say that tonight I was very pleased with the number of issues, the broad range of issues that we covered, and by the broad participation of the of people who joined us tonight. So God bless you all, and we'll keep fighting the good fight here, and we'll be in touch again soon.